Good evening. Tonight, we're pleased to have Tony Fratto, who is Principal Deputy Press Secretary at the White House, and who has been, how long have you been there now in that position?
As the Principal Deputy for maybe 5 months now, I guess, but I've been at the White House since, I guess, late September of 2006.
And before that, he was at the Treasury Department as the principal spokesperson. And let's start off with your upcoming trip. You're going to Africa later this week. And can you tell us something about what you're planning on doing, what your role is going to be there, and what kinds of things you can prepare beforehand, and what things are depend on what goes on when you get there?
Sure. I'm personally looking forward to it a lot because I've been to Africa about 7 or 8 times, to sub-Saharan Africa, and I'll be going back to all of these countries that I've been to before. And so I'll be.
Was that in Treasury?
At Treasury, yeah. Had a chance to. Because people don't understand this about Treasury. I knew it when I wanted to go there because it's something that I have a great interest in. But Treasury has the Treasury Secretary is the one of the governors of the World Bank and each of the World Bank Group banks, so the African Development Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, and also with the IMF. And so we have a fairly large development footprint and also have a lot of programs helping countries deal with things like putting together their budgets and putting in tax systems in place. You wouldn't know that we could give advice on tax systems, but we actually can help help some countries, given how screwed up our tax system is. But they seek our advice and like it, and of course we oversee the loans that go into a lot of these countries. And I had a chance to play a role in the debt cancellation deal that we did about 2 years ago to wipe out a lot of the debt for a lot of the heavily indebted poor countries, a large majority of which were African countries. So,
when you went with the Treasury Secretary, what kinds of things did you do then, and how will that compare with what you're going to be doing now for the president?
The only Treasury Secretary to have gone until Hank Paulson went a month or so ago, but before that was the famous Bono Paul O'Neill trip, which I spent a lot of time on and worked and put in that trip together. And so there's maybe no better way to go to Africa than to go with a Treasury Secretary and a rock star, and especially Bono's is very knowledgeable and engaging and. And so that was a one-of-a-kind trip. I know the reporters who went on that trip still talk about it. It was impressive, not just because of people like Bono, and actually people forget Chris Tucker was on that trip with us of Rush Hour fame, and we had an MTV crew with us. We had lots of fun things going on. But when you travel with a Treasury Secretary, it's a much smaller and more porous bubble than you do when you travel with a president. And so we were able to get out into small villages out in the open. We were able to walk in open air markets, which if you've ever been to Africa and you go to a West African market, they're just incredible places. It's lots of activity and lots of people, and the smell is something that you'll never forget, and you can do that with a Treasury Secretary. And the times that I traveled with a couple of undersecretaries in Africa, and you can get to places that you can't get to with a president. When a president comes in, it's got to be cleared. You need to sweep the place, and it's very difficult. And so that's a big difference. You won't necessarily see that kind of sort of spontaneous interaction with people, and I don't think any president anymore can ever have that kind of sort of open interaction with people in a country anymore. It's too dangerous. So that'll be different, but you'll see a lot of the same kinds of things in terms of the themes that we'll be talking about are a lot of the same themes that we talked about back in the spring of 2002, which is helping countries to help themselves in terms of getting rid of corruption, cleaning their balance sheets, putting institutions in place that are accountable, measuring results so that they have something to show when they come back and ask for ask for more funding for mm-hmm. for a project, they can show that the money was spent well. One of the I'll never forget a trip that we had taken to a school in Kenya. We'd gone to Kenya. We went to a small school in the Kibera slum in Nairobi, which is one of the world's largest slums, and just great interaction between the parents and the teachers and the tribal chief, and there were a couple chiefs, and so there was a little competition. But one of the things they did that they had on a board out in front of the school was they showed where every last shilling was spent and how it was spent that they had received from a grant. It actually wasn't a grant from the United States. It was a grant from DFID, from the UK's development agency. But what they were showing was how exactly where every last shilling went, mm-hmm. And they could account for it and show it. And so the parents and community leaders knew that the money was being spent well, and they knew that if their school was supposed to have 50 textbooks, they had 50 textbooks, and the kids were able to use them. And so that kind of accountability is impressive to policymakers back here who are making decisions on loans for developing countries. And it's when you're back here in Washington, it's hard to have a lot of confidence that the money's being spent well. And this was a message that we were taking to Congress as we were asking for more and more mm-hmm. funding. President Bush actually, in his first term, doubled funding for Africa and then doubled it again. So we were going to Congress and asking for more and more money, and Congress is skeptical, and they're scarce dollars, and they always have something else that they'd rather spend the money on. And foreign assistance isn't always the most popular budget request up on the Hill. And so we actually, we took pictures of things like that school and mm-hmm. and other evidence that we got from places around the world where the money was being spent well and it was accountable and was getting results. So, we'll do a little bit of that on this trip. President will be looking at some of the PEPFAR programs, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, where today about 1.4 million people in Africa are on antiretroviral mm-hmm. Drug treatments because of our country's generosity. And again, he has a budget request to double funding for that program also. So we're going to want to show to the media who are on the trip who don't pay attention to Africa. Mm-hmm. They may only do it on this one trip. This may be the only time that a lot of these reporters spend any time talking about, thinking about, and looking at what's going on in that continent, and show them some evidence of what's going on and try to get some attention for it. And, we'll be gone in a year. President Bush is committed to the programs that he has done for Africa. We'd like to get a little bit more attention so that, the next president will continue and maybe even grow what uh-huh. we've been able to start.
Well, it's been an interesting program. You all have spent more on Africa than any of your predecessors. Mm-hmm. Yet you've gotten very little credit for it. And why do you think that's the case?
There are probably lots of reasons for that. I think, obviously given the feelings about, well, let's start at the beginning, even before even getting into the feelings about America and this administration following Iraq. I think no one expected a Republican president, conservative, to be interested in development and in the continent. And actually, you know, you can go back and see where these programs started well before any of our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think since then, obviously, feelings about the administration are, you know, probably turned negative because of the controversy over taking that action in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think it's a hard place to pay attention to also. There's the only time, if you look at your newspapers over the past, you know, over the past 6 or 7 weeks, and the only thing you read about with respect to Africa is conflict, whether it's conflict in Congo or conflict in Kenya or Chad or Sudan, and you never, you know, your newspapers aren't going to write about, you know, the positive things that are going on there. So it's hard to get any attention for it at all.
Do you think that one of the things that's involved here too are changes in the news media? That so many news organizations have closed down their foreign bureaus that it's hard to get them interested. Probably you're right that conflict is something that draws attention.
I think that's true. I don't know that it's ever been much different with respect to Africa, though, and because, you know, a very good friend of mine who covers Africa for the New York Times, she and her family are moving to Johannesburg. Actually, they may be there already now. And she and I had this same conversation because she does a lot of writing on Africa. And, you know, she has a hard time getting those kinds of stories in the paper. And, you know, she spends a lot of time, puts a lot of work into, you know, very well-developed long pieces that she might be able to get in. Another reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Mike Phillips, who's a brilliant writer, I mean, one of my favorite reporters, and he covers a lot of different things. He covers the Treasury Department now full time, but he's covered the wars, and one of the things he does is cover Africa. He makes trips to Africa and writes some of the most creative, unique stories. He finds these stories that he can tell in a way, and he's able to find his way to the front page of the Wall Street Journal. But I'm impressed that he puts that much time and energy into it. He obviously cares about it a great deal and does great reporting and finds really good stories to tell. And I'm also impressed that the Wall Street Journal finds space for it because it's not a place where you expect to find stories on Africa, but they find space for it. And so I think, you know, you have to try. The conflict stories are very easy to write. I mean, they might be difficult to sort out in the reporting and to get at facts. But conflict, conflict happens, and you can do the reporting on that, and you can attach a picture to it. We see very ugly pictures of Africa in our newspapers, but you can tie that picture to a story, and it'll find space in a newspaper. But I think that the positive stories are harder to find, take a little bit more creativity, and there's not always a picture to go with it, too.
So in a way, one of the ways that you'll judge the success of this trip is judge what the communications is like.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of time and effort goes into that, thinking about, you know, which countries will we go to? What's the story that comes out of that country? What are we going to say? What will the reporters see when they get there? And how it translates back here? We're always speaking to a global audience or very various levels audience is. We're speaking, you know, we're speaking to the American people. We're speaking to other capitals around the world. You know, depending on the message, sometimes, you know, we may be speaking to troops in the field. We may be speaking directly to members of the appropriations committees and in Congress to get their attention. But we think a lot about that, about where, you know, where the president will go, and what the what the likely message is that's gonna come from that, and how it'll be interpreted, especially back here. I think we would really, you know, love to see. It's never something that's going to happen from any one trip, and a lot of people struggle with this. I know I mentioned Bono earlier from that trip we were on. We still do a lot of work with him and his staff, and he's on a constant, you know, mission to try to draw attention to Africa. And so, you know, you have a popular rock star who's out there every day trying to do this, and it's hard to do. But we'd like to see lots of people out there trying to draw attention to it, because it is one of the, you know, the great tragedies of our time. I mean, we talk about, you could look at you can see poverty in parts of Asia and in South America, but you don't see it on the poverty and disease on the scale that you do in Africa, anywhere else in the world. I mean, and the level of hopelessness. You don't really see that too many more places around the world as you do in Africa. So we want more attention. We want to bring people there. We want eyes to look at it, and we want businesses to take a fresh look at Africa, because these countries are making the very, very difficult decisions to be attractive to foreign investment. So we want to draw their attention to it and try to increase the level of investment in these countries. And we're speaking to all of those people when we do a trip like this.
Mm-hmm. How does that compare with, say, the kinds of trips that you set up in within the U.S.?
trips in the U.S. we can do on a, we could do at the drop of a hat. You know, you have infrastructure built in. We could send out, for any trip that we do, an advanced team will go out and work out, you know, everything, the site, the routes that the president will take, what, you know, who stays where in which hotel, where the press will stay, and where the filing center is, and can they get that out. When you travel to places like domestically or even in Europe, it's the infrastructure is so well built out. The people who are already in the ground. We have Secret Service offices in every country or every city in the country, they're already there on the ground and can get to work when a president comes in. For a foreign trip, it takes a great deal of elaborate planning and things. You know, things can change in the intervening time. You know, we have, we'll be going to Tanzania, and, did a lot of work on this trip, and the Prime Minister had to step down about 10 days ago, and so that will result in some changes that we have to deal with. But it takes months of planning to do a trip like that. And a lot of cities in Africa don't have all the built-out infrastructure that you need for essentially moving. It becomes a movable White House. It's in every part of it. You know, you have, it's not just the president; it's staff, it's the press corps,
How many people are you moving?
That's a great question. Say as many as 200 people will be moving in and out to each city, and there'll be a lot of others on the ground. I know the State Department will move lots of people in. Secret Service will move assets in from other places that will already be on the ground. But the number of people moving, easily maybe 250 people that will move from country to country, including the press corps.
Can you tell us? Let's go to your regular job of what you do at the White House on a daily basis. And when you're in the White House and doing briefings, tell us what kind of day you have, how it starts out, how you get information here, and when you start, like in the morning, what newspapers do you read? What do you listen to? What do you look at?
Well, I start pretty early. I mean, I wake up at 4 a.m. and then look at my BlackBerry and see if there's anything that came in overnight that that I need to look at, or you know, but try to go to bed at a reasonable hour. So sometimes later in the evening, something will come in that I need, you know, that I should have looked at. So my day starts at 4 a.m. and I get, you know, showered and changed and drive in and throw NPR on and listen to NPR, and I'll grab a coffee and the Washington Post, and my goal is to read the A section and maybe a story or two in the business section of the Washington Post before the Starbucks opens on 17th in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I'll go get another coffee and then come into the office and start going through the rest of the papers. And generally, the newspapers I'll look at are start with the Post, then the Times, the Journal, the FT, and USA Today are the papers that I'll get through before our first meeting. The first meeting in the press office is at 7:15, so I'll get in the office about 5:45. Other people get in between 6 and 6:30 in the press office, and we'll have our first meeting in the press office is at 7:15, where we basically go through the news and try to anticipate what we'll be dealing with on a given day. And then either Dana or I will, Dana Perino, the press secretary, or I will attend the senior staff meeting at 7:30 in the morning. This is the senior staff of the White House, headed by the chief of staff, and that meeting actually begins with a report from the press office, from me or Dana, talking about what are the major news items out there that we'll have to deal with. We get reports from Legislative Affairs next, and then the other offices of the White House will raise anything that they think senior staff may need to deal with or be on the lookout for during that day. We'll then go to our meeting with Ed Gillespie, who's counselor to the president and is really the head of all of the communications operations for the White House. We'll meet with Ed and do a little bit of the same thing. We could try to get a readout of, report on what was raised in senior staff meeting. And from that point on, what we're really doing, and actually, I mean, it really, really starts earlier, but the two polls that we deal with on a regular day at the White House are the morning gaggle and the briefing. The gaggle is off camera. Usually takes place at 9:30 in the morning, and the on-camera briefing takes place at 12:30, and it's a scramble to make sure that whoever is doing the gaggle that morning, 90% of the time that's Dana, is making sure she's ready for the likely questions that she's going to get from the press corps. So it's a scramble. I get a lot of people. All friends who come into town and say, "Can you, find time for breakfast?" And there's never a time for breakfast. Might be able to grab something on the run, but what you're really doing, is learning as much as you can of what's in the news, what are the issues, how should we talk about it, if we get questions, what can we say at the gaggle, and sometimes we do some planning and think ahead to the gaggle, something we may want to announce. There's usually foreign news that happens overnight that the White House needs to react to, and so we try to deal with that in the gaggle as early as possible. That takes you to, the gaggle takes place, and maybe by 10 o'clock we'll be thinking of some of the questions that we may not have had answers to or that we need better answers to for the briefing.
How do you know when an answer hasn't worked?
Usually it's, you know, usually we have something useful to say, but if we don't, it's probably because we haven't been able to gather the facts of what actually happened. Some event will occur and we'll get a question of, you know, well, what's the White House reaction to, you know, Iran launching a missile you know, and it takes a lot of time to make sure that you have, that you really have the facts right. And so sometimes you give an inadequate answer in the gaggle only because you haven't been able to do the fact gathering that you would like to do. Once you have the facts, generally know what we think about something. You can get you can have a discussion about, you know, what the implications are of something happening, or, you know, something happening on Capitol Hill, for example. You learn that they're going to take up a bill today that maybe was unexpected. You get a chance, you know, get a little chance to look at it and find out exactly what they're doing, and be in a better position to comment on it. But it's a race to do that for the 9:30 gaggle. But it's also, I think it's good for both the both for us and the press corps. We get a good sense of what is on the minds of the press corps, and we also get to, you know, give them a little bit of information on what's going on and what might be going on later in the day. Maybe if we add something to the schedule or try to give a preview on something the president may be saying later that afternoon. So the gaggle's sort of a good, you know, canary in the coal mine kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And because it's off camera, it's less formal and a little bit more, there's a little bit more give and take in the gaggle. Sometimes, you know, then you'll get to the briefing and you'll get the exact same question that you received in the gaggle. And it's usually the TV people who are looking for, you know, they wanted to raise it in the gaggle to let you know that it's coming. What they really want you to do is to be able to give them a good, full answer in the briefing where they have you on camera, and then maybe they can use it in their packages. So that's the way I think of the gaggle. Usually, by the time the gaggle's done at 10 o'clock, we're in some combination of meetings or events by the president, you know, where the president is involved in. You know, maybe it's policy time, or policy time is where the president will have staff in the Oval Office or in the Roosevelt Room to discuss a particular issue, and it's where he will make a decision based on the recommendations of his senior advisors.
How do those meetings go? How long are they? How many people are typically in them?
Well, it's really the end point of a process, and the president's usually been kept informed throughout the process. But it's a process that begins really with what's called the deputies' meeting. Mm-hmm. So the policy deputies, and even I've been fortunate enough to be in all of these meetings, but at the deputies' levels, where, for example, there may be a piece of legislation that is going to be introduced on the Hill, and we want to determine what should the administration position be on this bill. What are our options? And that begins at the deputies' level. There's a very thorough review. You have policy experts in the room. You know, staff from the agencies might be in the room, and there may be as many as 15 to 20 people at that time, and it's very informal, and there's a lot of give and take, and there's a lot of discussion of various options, and you try to, you know, learn as much as you can about what the implications are of the policy that's being proposed. What the Hill thinks about it, and try to narrow down the options of how we ought to respond to it, or try to change what's being proposed. So that happens, and that narrowing process will usually be followed by a meeting, what are called principals, the principals meeting. And these will be cabinet secretaries, the chief of staff, and other senior advisors in the White House offices. And that is a little bit more of a decision-making meeting. The options available will be, you know, greatly narrowed down, and we'll have a better sense of which direction we're going. A lot of things are decided in the principals' meetings, where the chief of staff or one of the lead policymakers will have had a chance to discuss it with the president and, you know, bring his questions back, or if he has particular firm views on something, we'll have a chance to debate it in the principals' meeting, and you make a determination as to whether you need to then take it back to the president in the form of policy time. And sometimes you'll have an opportunity to talk about how we can implement something because we had a good sense of what the decision was going to be. Or you bring, we haven't been able to come to a conclusion and resolution of a question. You bring those to the president, and he'll have a chance to hear from both sides and have some discussion. And he'll either make a decision there, or he'll tell you he'll come back and think about it a little bit and come back with his decision. But it was really remarkable. For me to say, I remember the first time I was in a policy meeting where, and this was in the Oval Office, and it was the first one where I saw a real dispute between between two of the president's advisors, and it was a great discussion and lots of good questions, and it wasn't arguing, but it was good presentation of views and which I didn't really expect to see, and so that was good to see. And actually, as it turned out, the president saw a third way that we probably should have thought about back in the deputies' meeting. But he saw where he wanted to be on it. That made a whole lot more sense than the two views that we had been arguing about for the past week. So that worked out well.
Are you there as bringing in the communications angle on the thought of how the policy is going to be sold?
That's the reason I'm there. I should say twofold. One is to talk about how it will be interpreted in the press. Whatever decision we make, that's one part of it. Is to bring that advice to the table and make sure people understand how the media would interpret something we do. The other part of it is to build up our equity knowledge in an issue, so that when we are standing at the podium, we know what we're talking about. You know, we've been able to follow a policy all the way through its development and get some level of expertise in talking about it, that we can be fluent talking about a policy. At least that's the way it works for me. And I've always taken advantage of my seat at the table, and no one's told me to shut up yet. But I've taken advantage of it to express my views on the policy itself and to get into those policy discussions. Like I said, I think they still welcome it, so I keep doing it until someone will tell me not to.
Have you ever had the discussion about communications on a policy where you point out that it's going to be very difficult to sell, and maybe the reason that it's going to be difficult to sell is that the policy, as it's structured at that point, is not mature, that more needs to be done? Because if you can't find an easy way of thinking about selling it, maybe there's something about the policy itself.
Yeah, that definitely happens sometimes. But it's really, I always come to that table with a sense that I don't want anyone thinking about how hard it might be to sell it. I might make them aware of that, but I don't ever want that to influence what the decision is. And I'll give you a good example of that. I remember a year ago when we were going through the budget for the and some of the proposals the president was going to make in the State of the Union address in January of 2007, went through a very elaborate policymaking process on the question of a proposal that we saw a problem in the tax code where some people who get health insurance get a tax break because health insurance is provided to them by their employer, mm-hmm. but if you purchase your own health care, you don't get a tax break. It's tax deductible. It's tax deductible if your employer gives it to you. And so the idea was to try to find some way of getting equity in the tax code so that everyone is treated mm-hmm. the same. And after a discussion of a lot of different ideas, the two ideas that we came down to try to do this was one, we call it the tax exclusion, which is just like a home interest, the interest deduction. Mm-hmm. It's just basically a deduction from your income taxes. Or you could do a tax credit. And in this case, you would just be able to just, deduct from the amount of taxes you have owed, mm-hmm. And it would be a flat rate, and it would be very easy to do. For a lot of reasons, a lot of us felt that the tax exclusion from a policy standpoint made much more sense. And it was a very close call on both of these because they both have pros and cons. But in terms of being able to communicate on it, tax credit would have been much, much easier mm-hmm. to communicate. Just a lot easier to understand. It would be flat. Everyone gets the same. Everyone gets the same benefit. And so, but we went through this very rigorous policymaking process, and the decision was to do the best policy was the tax exclusion. And so and so that's the way we went. And that was uh-huh. a decision that the president ultimately made. That his view, if it was the best policy, that's what we should do. Uh-huh. I think I have a phone ring somewhere. Uh-huh. Maybe it's in my coat. Hopefully. Right. So that was the decision he made. But I always felt all the way through that I don't want you to make a decision based on it. We'll try to meet the challenge on communicating it. Uh-huh. That's our job. And it's the Ledge Affairs job to try to sell it on the Hill. And so that's what we'll try to do. You guys try to come up with the best policy. So whatever the best policy is, just, for whatever the right reasons are and the goal that we're trying to reach, do that and let us deal with what we might need to do to sell it. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's a more responsible way to uh-huh. try to deal with it.
Yeah, I was just thinking in terms of sometimes if it can't be explained, then maybe that there's something wrong with the policy, that it needs more tweaking.
Yeah, in this case, I could say I don't think it could be. It was hard uh-huh. to explain, uh-huh. but I still do think it was the better policy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's go to some questions, and we'll take questions from both places. We'll start with Towson. Yep. Who's going to start it off? Okay.
With the campaign starting up, like a big deal, and that one wants to go. Is there a particular strategy the White House is going to use to keep themselves in the spotlight, or is it understood it's time for you guys to step out of the limelight to the election?
Can you start over, because at the beginning we couldn't hear what you're saying.
With the campaign season starting a year ago and 9 months left. Is there a particular strategy the White House is going to use to stay in the spotlight or in getting the president's message out, or is it understood as you're trying to step out?
Yeah, it's definitely an increasing challenge to try to get attention for the things we're doing. But that's probably right. I mean, the things that are important will get attention for. But I think we all understand. All of us have been through presidential campaigns before, and it's very natural that attention is going to begin to focus on the candidates, and that's probably right. There's still a lot to do, and there's still lots of areas that we need to be mindful of, and we'll still have a major role in. Obviously, in foreign policy, we'll still have a big footprint there, and we'll still get attention for those things. But in terms of a domestic agenda, that's a little bit tougher, not least of which because Congress isn't going to be as active either as they get closer to their own election day also.
Mm-hmm. Is that one of the reasons that presidents travel in their last year?
You know, a lot of people have raised this with me, and I reminded them that our travel is actually not a whole lot different from what it was last year. I mean, you'll travel a little bit more. I think there are probably two trips that are...
We've already, this year, you've gone to the Middle East, and now you're going to Africa, and that's 2 months in.
That's right, and I'll go back to the Middle East, and then a trip to Beijing for the Olympics. The other trips are trips that he makes every year, to the G7,
yeah,
to NATO, to the APEC meeting. And so I only see two quick trips that are in addition to what we did. You know, last year we went to Latin, to South America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this year we're going to Africa. So it's not so different. But,
okay.
Yeah.
Somebody like to ask a question here?
Yeah.
We're going to do here and then we'll go back.
After a new president is inaugurated?
Catch up on sleep, first of all. Definitely want to do that. And my wife asked me the same question a lot, wondering what I'm going to do. I'm not ready to think about it yet. I think I need... I always felt like whenever I was getting towards the end of, my whole career has been largely in politics, and stepping out of it. So I always knew that every 2 years or 4 years, or
mm-hmm.
I was in the Senate 6 years, that at some point I was going to have to make, very likely, or at least the possibility that I was going to be losing my job. But I saw people planning their next move,
uh-huh.
and I never really liked to see that. I always thought if you're planning your next move, you're probably gone already.
Yeah.
So I think it's bad for for you and your and morale and how hard you need to work to be able to do well. So I think I'll wait till we get later in the year, maybe after the conventions and start thinking about it then. But yeah, but my wife is definitely asking me that that question.
It's generally been a hard place to look for a job from. While you're working,
mm-hmm.
that if you go say meet with people and you're going out to lunch, then it gets in the style section of the post.
That's true.
Yeah,
I don't
so
have to be paying attention
every,
to mine in the style
yeah.
section. My recruiting opportunities, but you never know.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, Towson.
Okay. Before still dealing with the press corps through the gaggle and the briefing, do you try to anticipate questions from certain reporters, and are there any instances where you were asked a question that you definitely didn't anticipate, that it completely threw you and maybe Dana Farina for a loop, and you just don't know where it came from?
Yeah, that happens a lot. I mean, I've tried to get really good at predicting who is going to ask what question. It's one of the little, I guess, little games we have, but it's necessary for us to sort of anticipate, who's going to ask what. In some cases, it's really easy. Certain media outlets have certain interests, like the AFP reporter for Agence France Presse. They have an interest in anything French and anything and a lot of things Middle East. So we can always expect that quite mm-hmm. if anything's happened in Iran, we'll get a question in Iran from one of our AFP. Reporters. We have a reporter from India who will mm-hmm. ask in any context a question relating to India.
What about the wires? What do you expect from the wires?
The wires are generally looking for the most immediate news item, mm-hmm. and I think they're fairly predictable. It's usually whatever the most recent breaking news item is. Where the newspapers have a longer view, only in the sense that, they may be putting something up on the website later in the day, but they're really looking at, how they can get on the front page the next day, and so they can take a step back. But the wires are looking for very immediate headlines. So whatever is breaking, we're going to get from the wire reporters sitting in the first row. And actually, the cable TV guys are essentially wire reporters also, and they act the same way. So so CNN is someone who will be asking about whatever is breaking very quickly. The NBC reporter who will be trying to get on MSNBC will be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's really the from those reporters the most immediate and really the most obvious questions. On some days when there is not a big breaking news story, it's wash day, and you can get questions on whatever mm-hmm. comes to mind. I mean, sometimes I think we shouldn't have a. There are certain days when I think we should just tell everyone we don't need a gaggle today, and we're not going to do it because the reporters aren't necessarily. If there's not, sometimes there just isn't news, or there isn't. News that's important enough to deal with it that way in sort of a press conference setting, and the questions can come from all over. And Dana has tremendous judgment on what the reporters will ask. She's been in that room a lot longer than I have, and has a real good sense for it. And so usually by 8 o'clock, I'll have a request from Dana. I've tried to get much better at anticipating it, but I mean today was a good example where if there was the story that General Motors lost a record amount of mm-hmm. money in the last quarter, almost $40 billion. It's a relatively big story. It's not a natural question for the White House that you would ask about a company losing money, and Dana, I'd been preparing some talking points for her on three or four different issues, and she hit me with an email. What will I say when they ask me about GM? And my first reaction to myself was, well, they're not going to ask you about GM. And sure mm-hmm. enough, she got a question from GM, and so I did put talking points together for mm-hmm. her, and she used them. We were able to talk through how we should think about reacting to that news. But if she hadn't thought about it, not mm-hmm. not long before the briefing, it was maybe only 20 minutes before the briefing. she would have. I don't know what she would have said because it's a little bit tricky on how you want to react to something like that.
What is TV? What do you associate with television, with the networks?
Boy, the networks are changing in that what I see happening with the networks are they're becoming much more, consumer, kitchen table issue forums at the national level that I don't remember so much when I was, when I was growing up. I always thought about what I got from local TV news. And I grew up in a family where we read the newspapers and we watched the local news and one of the network news broadcasts every night. And that was, mm-hmm. And the Sunday morning shows, we always did that. And what I always remember looking for on, local news were the more of the kitchen table issues. And in the national news, you saw the bigger issues of the day, and a lot of international news. And I see today TV reporters having a much easier time getting on TV when you have something that that gets right into people's homes. And today the Treasury had their announcement on ways to help homeowners keep to work with lenders and try to get out of some of the bad loans that they're in right now. If there's any news on housing right now, you're going to get on TV. And so they're looking for those kinds of stories. They're not going to get on TV with Africa. They're not going to get on TV with Iraq today unless something very very bad happens or there's a major shift in policy, and so things like a couple of the examples were any of the things we did in housing. We did an announcement on some things we were doing with the airline industry, which is just shortly before the travel season started, and
right,
it was just fit right into the kinds of things that they were thinking about and that they think Americans are thinking about. They think Americans are thinking about more about those kinds of at-home issues rather than what's going on in other parts of the world. So that's a different trend that I see.
Uh-huh. Somebody here have a question?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
We'll do him, and then next we'll do you, after we go to Towson. Yeah.
You were talking about the budget, and I was wondering to what extent details about the budget are hammered out in those meetings you were talking about, and to what extent they just kind of materialize out of OMB.
Now, OMB is funny because, I joke, the guy that I hired at Treasury, it was a really, really, really good communicator, just very experienced, and we hired him over at the White House to be the press secretary for OMB, and his last day was yesterday. But I used to joke all the time because OMB is really the organizing body for policy, and one of the things they do is because they have all of the best communications links with all of the departments and agencies. When we put something out called the Statement of Administration Policy, it comes out of OMB. They do all the work, and it's a document that says Office of Management Budget and Statement of Administration Policy. And I suggest he's the most powerful person in government. He's one that they're the ones always pronouncing on what a lot of our policies are. And I'll see them citing the White House, citing OMB on a policy issue. But what OMB does in terms of the budget is, they are, they're looking at the economic projections with what they get from something called the Troika, which is the Treasury Secretary, the head of OMB, and the Council of Economic Advisors, and they work together to think about what the economic projections are for the future, what expected revenues are, and try to make a determination on what the size of the budget should be, and then they manage the process of departments and agencies coming forward with their requests, and just fighting. It's it's a battle, and there's a lot of give and take. It starts early. Let's say, you know, the process probably starts in late summer or early fall, and you work through a lot of these ideas, and there are also ideas being generated at the White House, and you get a sense from the president and policymakers at the White House of what the president, you know, what his priorities are. But it is until that budget is released on you know, usually the first Monday in February or a week after the State of the Union address, it is an ongoing battle, and there are appeals processes, and so OMB is in the middle chair on all of those. They make some of the decisions, but those decisions can always be, you know, can always be appealed to a higher power, and sometimes it's the chief of staff, mm-hmm. and the chief of staff can make those decisions. But any cabinet secretary who feels strongly enough to want to take a decision on a budget item to the president can do that, and some of them do. And I think it was reported in the newspaper that I think Condi did that with a couple of her programs. So they really manage it, but they're not really they may be the first line of enforcing budget discipline, but they're not, you know, they're not the last line. They can be a tough hurdle to go through because they'll quiz you. You know, an agency will come forward with a proposal, and they will, you know, really force you to get very, very deep in terms of what you, you know, how effective you think it's going to be. Why do you think it only costs this amount of money when we know that, you know, this is happening, it's going to cost more, and, you know, so they have those battles. They're fun to watch. I go to a lot of those budget meetings. That isn't a place where I get. I won't weigh in a lot because sometimes it's just fun to sit back and watch this wrestling match over uh-huh. the policy issues. Yeah.
Yeah. Towson.
That's something that we've tried to get better at finding one or two issues a day that we can try to maybe lead off the briefing or the gaggle with, and we'll think about a message that we want to get out publicly that might affect something during the day. Today, the FISA reform bill was being voted on in the Senate, and so I wrote an opening for Dana to use to talk about what we'd like to see the Senate do today, and encouraging them to pass the bill by the end of the day, which they did about an hour ago, and so that's the way. Well, we definitely try to look at those days. Sometimes there isn't something that rises to that level, and we'll walk in and just go straight to questions. But I think more often than not, we're looking for something that we can try to highlight, you know, each day, and at least try to break through a little bit on something. Sometimes the best thing is just supporting and previewing what the president might be doing later in the day, and that frequently gets a lot of coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It gets to give when we do something like that. If we give something about what the president is going to say later in the day, it allows the wires and the TV people to go out and have something to talk about to preview uh-huh. themselves, and so that.
Right.
That
and then afterwards, so in a sense, they're going to tell their audience what they're going to tell them, what he's going to tell them. Then they have time with him.
That's
where
right.
he tells it.
He tells it.
And then afterwards, you tell them what they told him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Today actually
it
was
three hits.
Yeah. Today was interesting because we had an event on the schedule that was. It was in celebration of African American History Month, and it's not generally a you know, the those kinds of events. We do, you know, we do a lot of them. They're good to do and important to do, but they're not necessarily news-making events. But today, the president wanted to take advantage of African American History Month to talk about something that that was on his mind that he felt very, very strongly about, and that was you know, some of the recent awful reports we've seen around the country of either malicious or whether they were pranks, but the use of the noose as a symbol, and he very much wanted to mm-hmm. use that opportunity today to deliver a very strong message on that, and we didn't want people to miss it because it's something that he felt personally very strongly about. So there was something in there that the media would absolutely be interested in, and so we made sure during the briefing today that Dana talked about the fact that the president was going to be, you know, was going to be saying something more than the regular kind of sort of celebratory right. talk that you hear at these kinds of events, and that did make news, and we're glad that it did, and it was, you know, mm-hmm. so that, I mean, it was good that it did. It was the reporters were very appreciative to know that there was something they absolutely ought to be taking mm-hmm. paying attention to, and they did, and they used it and covered it extensively. Yeah. This evening.
CNN, I think, ran almost the whole thing.
They did, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Including the Temptations.
It's great. I couldn't be in the room, but love the Temptations. Yeah. I miss them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hi, I'm just curious if you think when it comes to like the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, mm-hmm. like, if you get asked a lot of hard questions, or when you answer them, you think they're easy answers, if you're satisfied with your answers.
I think
it's always contentious.
It is, and it's I guess it's trite to say it's one of the most difficult issues that that we or any other president has tried to address those issues has to deal with. There are the politics surrounding Israeli-Palestine issues are labyrinthine, and you know, you can ask, a Palestinian and Israeli experts, you have both of them in the room, and they'll give you different views on what's going on. And, you know, and we are trying to push the leaders of both the Palestinian Authority and Israel to try to come to a lasting agreement. And, you know, I don't know whether we'll be successful or not, but there are certainly people out there who want to disrupt that process, and there's obviously an enormous amount of skepticism that it can, you know, that it can be done. And we're as skeptical as anyone is. It's one of the great challenges of our time. So. Something happens like today. There was news that the Israelis had some announcement on settlements in East Jerusalem, and you know, it was hard to figure out whether that was a new announcement, an old announcement. We obviously understood the feelings of the Palestinians. We don't know what the intentions of the Israelis were. We don't know who, you know, it's hard to find out who made the announcement. So when you get questions on those kinds of things and you're trying to keep your message, you want to take a step back and try to keep your overall message clear and consistent, and if it is, some entity out there trying to cause a disruption in this process that we're trying to nurture, you don't want to add fuel to that. You want to try to, bring temperatures down and try to get the facts straight and try to keep everyone on the track going forward and not let it disrupt. So that's tough to do. We're up there as spokesmen, and we can, you know, we can always say something stupid that is, you know, that causes problems for our people working on these issues. It's not, you know, it's not hard to say something stupid up there. I think they can all be hard questions, but I think I think the issues are hard. I don't think the questions are hard. You know, the questions are usually fairly straightforward, but I think the issues are hard and complex, and it's hard to give good answers on very, very complex issues. I think that's what is hard. The amount of information that you're trying to keep in your head, and also trying to analyze with the questioner, the intention of the questioner, what their aim is, and what information they're trying to get. Sometimes that's hard.
Towson?
Do you find it hard to keep pressure when you get questions? Like when the guy asked tried the Japanese soldiers for waterboarding, and then we do it, and you get sprung like a question. Do you find it's hard to keep your composure and just not say anything about it when that's kind of, I mean, I could imagine it'd be hard not to say something on a question like that, because it's kind of...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I hope I kept my composure. They did ask me that question, and I mean, I had the joy of doing two gaggles and two briefings last week on... They were almost solely devoted to waterboarding, and which isn't a fun issue to want, you know, to have to handle at a briefing. But I don't know. I try to stay steady. Helen will, you know, Helen Thomas will try to interrupt and try to knock you off your game a little bit, but. You can't take it. I guess the problem is if you take it personally with the reporters, maybe you could lose your composure. I try really, really hard not to, and try to just, you know, hear what the question is and think about how I want to respond to it. I think I did get actually a little bit, I don't know if I was emotional, but I'd been waiting for that kind of question for a long time and really wanted to answer it, actually. And so I was kind of, I didn't like hearing the question, but I think I was ready to answer it.
How do you diffuse the heat that can exist in the relationship? Because reporters want information from you. They want you to make news. And on the other hand, when you come out, you don't necessarily want to make news. And so you can have a tension and some conflict. What are some of the ways you try to reduce that on a regular basis, not necessarily in that room, but elsewhere?
Well, I'm soft on reporters. But I generally like reporters, and I have relationships with them. And I think the reporters in our press room know that I, you know, regardless of what questions they ask, or sometimes even how they ask them, that I respect them, and I've never really had a problem with a reporter. David Gregory and I think had something once, but it wasn't bad, and he's a friend, and away from, you know, out of the press room, he's a friend, and so. I don't know. I just always try to, in my mind, try to respect the question. There's a reason a question's being asked. I usually have a pretty good sense of why a question is being asked, even if it's not a question that I, might think of as respectful, maybe the topic is, and so I don't necessarily have to answer the question, but I can address the subject in a way that's. That's helpful and maybe even direct where the importance of the question is. Sometimes reporters are asking the wrong question. They're asking a question about something that sort of that might miss the point. And so I'll try to help them, know what the real important aspect of the issue is that we're dealing with. And we're trying to do both.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody here who hasn't asked a question? Okay, sure, if you want to.
No, I mean, I was trying to actually think of an example of it, and nothing's coming to mind right now, a specific example. But sometimes a reporter will ask a question based on, based on what they read in the New York Times that morning, I don't say that as though they're lazy or anything. I mean, people read the New York Times, and there it is on the front page, and so it's a question that they have to ask. But there might be a lot more to the story that the New York Times might have missed. And again, I don't say that as critical of the New York Times. It's just that stories are complex, and I'll just try to make sure that that they're seeing it from a couple different sides, and try to give. Just try to give as much information as I can. I work really, really hard to try to know as much about an issue as I can. You know, our policy guys are tough to get to in terms of, a reporter being able to ask them a question because they're working. They're working on whatever it is they're doing. And I love policy. I'm actually an economist, I handle our economic portfolio in addition to the other stuff. The other issues I cover, and I've always thought the best way I can help a reporter, I have reporters who are friends. I'm not doing it to help them. My ultimate goal is to try to get good substantive stories in the newspaper. But the best stories I see written, the best from everyone's perspective, including our own at the White House, are the ones that have the most that have the facts. Right, and so I try to learn as much as I can. I think the best service I can do is to be authoritative when I'm standing up there, and to really, really know the substance of my subject, so I can help the reporters, and also that's where good stories come from, or better stories come from is by us helping reporters get the best information. That they can get. I don't know. Some people can do it different ways. Some people can take talking points and read them, and maybe through some powers be able to to spin reporters to write what they like in the right. I'm not very good at that, and so I start really early, and I go home. When I leave here, I'll go home and eat, and I'll start studying again until I go to bed, and because I think that's the best way I can do my job is to just try to learn as much as I can, and to be able to give reporters as much as they need. Yeah.
One more question from Towson, and then we'll let him go home and study
I have to rescue my car from the garage before it closes.
You're talking about waterboarding.
To come to you, do you always have to wait for an issue to be asked, or is there any way you can sort of gear the reporters to cover that topic?
Yes, I mean sometimes just the asking a question about a reporter might have a very specific question, and I could use that as a hook to answer their specific question, but then also because they introduced the subject matter, be able to talk about something else that I'd also like to talk about. In that case, I mean, none of that was particularly pleasant, and not so much because of the subject matter, but because they're very, very complicated legal questions in terms of how I can talk about that subject and how I can talk about intelligence gathering and how to be accurate in how I talk about the law and how it impacts what the government was doing, and So I spent a lot of time with the lawyers, White House Counsel's office. Those are a lot of my best, you know, best friends on this job. Spent a lot of time working with them on those kinds of issues that, that deal with our intelligence programs and making sure that I'm not getting, you know, anyone, I'm not getting anyone else in trouble, but also I don't want to hire a lawyer either. So I want to try to be, you know, make sure I'm not getting, I don't have to get myself lawyered up because of something wrong I said. So so that was, that, you know, but that question in particular was, you know, something, the question had to do with, if you didn't see, it had to do with sort of different standards for this debate that we were going through in terms of the legality of our interrogation programs, and obviously lots of views on it. But the one there was a point I wanted to make and was looking for an opportunity to make, and that was that our enemies are not asking themselves those questions. The terrorists who are trying to attack our country, those people who were on who flew airplanes into the World Trade Center towers, they weren't asking about, you know, the rights of the victims. They weren't asking about, you know, what, you know, how the law treat them, and frankly, they didn't really care about how the law treated themselves either, because they had a different mm-hmm. mission. But we struggle with these questions. We have very public debates. We have all three branches of government, the legislative branch, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch, struggling with how we balance our need for national security and intelligence gathering with the need, the equally critical need of protecting Americans' privacy rights and what it means to be an American and to deal with those kinds of issues. They're very, very difficult questions for all of us, and I think it's an important debate to have, and it's important to try to find us in the right place. But I was waiting for someone to ask the question about, you know, I'm trying to think of how the question exactly was worded, but that would, you know, but it put me in that place of sort of a reciprocal kind of, you know, is it the same on the other side? At least that's the way I heard the question, mm-hmm. and it's not the same on the other side. They are not reading Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. To, you know, that wasn't what Danny Pearl, the people who captured Danny Pearl, they didn't have concern for whether their actions were in keeping with common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. But we struggle with it, uh-huh. and we should struggle with it.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you.
Yeah.